Glenn Reynolds, it's a thrill to hear the voice of the Instapundit.
Well, it's great to be here.
Let me just say, you know, when I was in school, my idea of a god of journalism was Walter Lippmann. He had lunch at the Metropolitan Club every day, talked to big shots, and then was sometimes talked to them at home next to the National Cathedral there in Washington. And they turned out these beautifully phrased short essays for American newspapers twice a week, distilling the mood and the mind of Washington and, of course, shaping it. Today, the Walter Lippmann is a University of Tennessee law professor with a thing about guitars and Mazda sports cars, who's reading hundreds, maybe thousands of websites all the time and cueing the rest of the world to where the good stuff is. I want you to tell me how the world created this monster Instapundit.
Monster is probably the right word. I am hardly in the Walter Lippmann category. About all I can say is that my rate of fire exceeds his. But that's about all. I am. I think that it's not my column that does that sort of thing. The way columnists like Lippmann or like Scotty Reston used to sort of set the mood and control shape the dialogue. It is really a question of the blogosphere playing that role, of which I'm just a part.
Yeah, don't be too modest, but make your point.
Well, it's true. I mean, my readers are smarter than I am, and the blogosphere as a whole is certainly smarter than either I am or any subset of the blogosphere is. I mean, it is absolutely a case where distributed intelligence trumps individual expertise.
And it's a democracy, egalitarian, meritocratic, good ideas rise to the top, others don't. It is a better world, I think.
Well, it's more a functioning anarchy than a democracy, I think. But I mean, it's a case in which lots of decisions made by lots of individuals add up to sort of a whole that's more than the sum of the parts. And I think that it usually is that way.
How did it happen in your case?
I started blogging really kind of by accident. In that I was sort of looking, I teach internet law, and I like to do new and different stuff on the web. And I was sort of looking for something new and different to do, and I was an admirer of Mickey Kouse and Virginia Postrel and some of those other people. So as a result, you know, I decided to start a blog and really thought that it would do well if I could get a couple of hundred people to read it. And as it turns out, it's done rather better than that in terms of the number of readers, though I'm not sure that the tone is all that different than it would have been if I had a couple of readers, because for me, the experience is the same. I sit at my computer and I type stuff. I'm not like Walter Lippmann. I don't meet big shots at the Metropolitan Club. I don't have a lot of close social relations with famous people. I exchange email with some of them, but I really go about my fairly ordinary life out over in flyover country and just do my thing.
Well, let's talk about that. Interesting points. You were the heart and mind of the Bush administration in a certain way on the war, and yet there you are in Tennessee. This is not fuselage journalism anymore. You're not talking to White House staff or fellow reporters. Do you have sources? Do you have tips?
I do. I mean, I don't know that I'm the heart and mind of the Bush administration. I mean, I know there are some people in the White House who read my site, but whether they are persuaded by it or whether it affects their actions in any way, you'd have to ask them.
I was thinking of Doc Searles also, who compares you to PFC Wintergreen, the mail clerk in Catch-22, and the thought was that he actually was the only person in the world who understood World War II as it was unfolding. And he's compared you to PFC Wintergreen as the kind of a secret core of the mind of the war in Iraq. I mean, could that be?
I certainly hope not. No, I don't think so. I mean, I think I have the advantage that I am a quick thinker and a quick writer, and I was the kind of weird kid who read the encyclopedia from one end to the other. So, I mean, that's an advantage when things are moving fast. I think there's a lot of stuff I understand. It's also pretty clear to me that there's some stuff I don't, and I try to make sense of it as best I can, and sometimes you just have to wait and see how it turns out. In terms of sources, yeah, I get email with tips all the time, and some, you know, it obviously varies in quality, but the thing that's really struck me since my readership got big enough that I got a lot of email is just how many smart people there are out there and just how much they know. And I think one of the nice things about blogging is you're able to take advantage of that. I mean, I just posted a report from a guy I call my Afghanistan correspondent. He's a longtime reader and a professor at Boston University who was in Kabul last summer and is back this summer. And he's sending me two or three reports a week. And it's almost, they read almost like P.J. O'Rourke, and he's observing a lot of stuff that you're not seeing in the mainstream media. And I have people in other places who do that, and I have a lot of people who scour the web and send me links to stuff that looks interesting. It really means that, you know, the blog knows more than I do, in a sense, because it takes advantage of how smart a lot of readers are.
I think that's fascinating, and it reminds me of discoveries I made as doing a smart talk show on public radio. It was a complete discovery for me how smart this country is. Traditional media loves to look down on the customers for different reasons, but when you give people the chance just to be their best and make sense, this is an amazingly confident, well-educated, smart culture we live in.
That's absolutely true, and actually, to invoke a different columnist, I'm in some ways a big admirer of H.L. Mencken. He was certainly a terrific writer.
Yep.
But Mencken's biggest flaw was that he thought he was a lot smarter than his readers. And indeed, he thought Americans in general were stupid. And that was sort of a centerpiece of his writing. And he was just plain wrong about that. And it was probably gratifying to him to feel that smart, and it was gratifying to a lot of his readers to think that, well, I'm not quite as smart as H.L. Mencken, but I'm smarter than most Americans, because at least I read H.L. Mencken and laugh at his jokes. The truth is, there are just so many smart people out there. They are not by any means limited to professions traditionally associated with smart people,
right,
like professors and
right,
journalists and such. And they are enormously competent. In fact, I got an email just today about that. I had linked to the blog of a military guy in Iraq named L.T. Smash. That's not his real name. I actually know his real name, but he blogs anonymously. And the reader said, you know, I've been reading these military blogs and emails that you've been sending, and I just can't believe how keenly observant and how literate they are. And so I don't think most people realize how much talent there is in the military. And I mean, I think that's absolutely right. But I think it's true of American society as a whole.
I think
people
you're right.
Are just smarter.
I think you're right. And it's not just Americans either. I mean, so what do we do with all this information to which access is now very easy, open, and it's going to be more and more as people get plugged in? I mean, there are a lot of active brains out there. How assimilate them? How hear them all?
Well, we're still sort of in the early stages, I think, of dealing with that. The technologies for spreading information have been in advance of the technologies for sorting out truth from crap for quite
right,
a while.
Right.
And I actually think we're beginning to see the sorting function catch up. Weblogs, to some degree, are part of that. I mean, one of the cool things about weblogs is the variety of sort of auxiliary things that have grown up with them. Like if you see a weblog post and you wonder whether to believe it or not, you can enter the URL in the TechnoWriter link cosmos and see what other people say about it.
Amen.
For that matter, you can do that with a news story and see what bloggers are saying about it. And often, when I see something and I'm not sure about it, I'll do that, and I will wind up learning something I otherwise would probably never have been able to find out.
We love TechnoWriter for many purposes. I like the idea that we've been much better at putting out the signal than sorting them coming back.
Well, let me go a little further on that. The old saying was that the truth, or rather, a lie makes it halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on.
Right.
And I just don't think that's true anymore. The truth is pretty fast. If you want, for example, to fact-check Paul Krugman, usually Andrew Sullivan and other people have critiques of his columns posted by 1 a.m. long before most people have read the columns in print.
And Max Sawicki is fact-checking you and Andrew Sullivan at the same time. No, or somebody is.
I actually don't read his blog very much. Ever since he called me Professor Instacrap, I've found it hard to take him seriously. But
well, I just mean to say, no, I'm just, I was really
but,
trying
but
to say
no,
that
you're
there's transparency all across the
you
board.
You see it all the way across the board, and I certainly don't mind if people want to link to my stuff and criticize it or whatever, and I'm happy that people can see it via Technorati. I do think that you're right, that you've got transparency at all levels, and that's certainly my take. One of the things that the blog format does is you link to stuff, and then you write what you think about it. And the beauty of the link is that if people don't agree with you or wonder whether they should trust you, they can follow the link and read it for themselves and make up their mind. And that's true for most of what's on blogs. Now, some of it's not. When you have original first-hand reporting on blogs, you have to apply the kind of skepticism that you apply to original first-hand reporting from anyone. Since you can't see the raw data, you just have to decide whether you trust them. And that's always going to be the case, I think. But it is a much more open and transparent field than really any kind of journalism that we've ever had before.
Is it going to overtake journalism? Or maybe I should put it, when is it going to overtake journalism?
Well, you know, I don't think weblogs are going to put the New York Times out of business. I do think, though, that you will gradually see a sort of more horizontal model for journalism. You know, traditionally, you had sort of a pyramidal organization within a news paper or other pieces of news media, in which you had a bunch of reporters at the bottom, and then you had sort of editors in the middle, and then you had an editor-in-chief and a publisher at the top. And information sort of came in through the reporters and flowed up, and then when it got to the top, it flowed out and to the readers in a one-way stream. And, you know, the only feedback you got was, well, the reader could write a letter to the editor, which might or might not be published and might or might not be read, but which would appear, if at all, days or weeks after the original story was forgotten. Now it's very different. Now it's a much more horizontal model, and I can imagine that you'll see a situation in which you can have a newspaper that has a whole lot of bloggers, if you want, and a central organization that does no more than link to these first-hand reports and draw correlations among them in a much more flat sort of system, operating kind of more like an email list in some sense.
Yeah.
And you could set something like that up now. Slashdot is a sort of early version of that in a way. And for that matter, if you take the blogosphere and combine it with Technorati, you've got sort of an early version of that too. If you wanted it to be more sophisticated, what you could do is add sort of trust ratings to sources. And actually, Technorati sort of lets you do that because it lets you rank things by blog authority, which is kind of halfway there. But I can imagine a system in which it could really be pretty sophisticated. And I suspect we will see that sort of thing grow as the software gets better and as the network gets larger.
Glenn Reynolds, I love your memoir on the war in Iraq as it was reflected in Blog World. Everybody agrees that it was better debated in Blog World than in the newspapers or television or Congress, certainly. And you were conspicuous, you know, in the pro-war camp. How was that for you? What kind of an adventure was that? It built up Instapundit in a very big way, did it not?
I suppose it was a very tiring exercise for me. You know, one of the interesting things is the question people always ask about Instapundit is how I'm able to write so much. And the writing is the easy part. It's the reading and the digesting and the thinking about unpleasant things that's the hard and stressful part. And I have to say that the many months run-up to the war took a lot out of me in that regard. And I think blogging is harder that way than other forms of journalism because you don't have an editor or coworkers to talk with and go out and have a beer with as you work. You're kind of on your own dealing with all this stuff, and it is troubling and stressful. You know, there are all these psychological studies that show that the more you follow the news, the more stressed and depressed you tend to be. And, you know, even the people in the high news following groups in those studies don't follow the news nearly as closely as bloggers do. So we may see burnout as a serious factor. But I did find it tiring. At the other level, I mean, What troubled me about the war debate really was that most of it wasn't about the war. That, you know, the war was sort of an excuse for people to argue sub rosa about American power and Western culture and all sorts of other issues. And I felt that a lot of that was done somewhat dishonestly.
Those aren't exactly sub-issues. And I should say, I was not for the war at all. But why is not the question of American power part of that whole discussion?
Well, it is and it isn't. I don't mind people talking about the question of American power. I just don't like them to pretend they're talking about the welfare of Iraqi widows and orphans while they do it. And I think that was the part that I found... the right word, disturbing, perhaps, or
disappointing. Well, they're different questions.
In the discussion, the story is that generals are always preparing for the last war, but I think that statement was first of all made with regard to French generals, actually, and second of all, it really hasn't been true for 50 years at least. But our war debate seems stuck in the Vietnam era, and we've had quite a few wars since then, and none of them have been Vietnam, and I find it sort of troubling that people reach for Vietnam stereotypes to some degree on both sides.
Well, we have Vietnam stereotypes, and we fall back on equally misleading Hitler stereotypes, you know, in the case of Milosevic or Saddam, too. I mean, leaving that aside for a moment, I wonder what drove you through that ordeal, what doubts you had, who you thought was your opposition. Who were the counter Insta pundits that you respected and wanted to do battle with? And what's the score at the end? Not on the battlefield, but in the blogosphere?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't see blogging that way. I mean, I don't sit around wondering who the counter Insta pundits are and how I'm going to do battle with them. For me, and again, you know, that maybe that's partly because I do this by myself in front of my computer.
Mm.
It's not a perception of doing battle. I mean, for me, what's really interesting are the stories more than the personalities and the developments. And I think, to some degree, my sense of sort of what's being shorted or misrepresented in the general media coverage. And I think a lot of bloggers feel that way, and they feel that way differently depending on their perspective. A lot of left anti-war bloggers felt that the media was absurdly pro-war, which to me seemed itself absurd because I felt that the media was rather anti-war. But in both cases, what people tended to do was to say, well, they're not giving you the whole story. Look at these stories that they're not playing up that I think are important. And I think naturally people's choice of what stories they think are important is driven to a large degree by what they think is important. So it varies from one blogger to another. But that's okay, because, I mean, the beauty of the blogosphere is that there are all these blogs, and they come at the same problem from a whole lot of different angles. When you get your news from, you know, Fox News or the BBC or whoever, you tend to get it from a single angle, and it's useful to be able to look at it from a lot of different sides. And when you add to that the virtues of hyperlinks and archives and things like that, I think you do get a fuller picture through weblogs.
No question about it in my mind, or I don't think it's even arguable. To me, the question, though, is why that blog argument hasn't had more effect on the rest of the world, on Congress, for example. I mean, the Congress is way, way behind, it seems to me, in the argument, where we used to expect it, and sort of constitutionally, it should be right there.
You're just starting to see the impact of the blogosphere penetrate into mainstream politics. I had a story I linked yesterday from Slate that... John Kerry was running away from a blogger who's covering the Democratic primary, which I thought was just hilarious.
Right.
But, you know, I think one thing that bloggers and everybody need to remember, both the people who boost the power of the blogosphere and the people who don't, is that it's really very difficult to change people's minds about anything and via any medium. You know, and I think that if you look at, you know, if you look at the... New York Times war coverage, it didn't really drive the polls on the war very far, even though the New York Times was rather anti-war. If you look at Paul Krugman's
column, record, the New York Times endorsed the war.
Well, not all of us would agree.
Oh, come on. Bill Sapphire and Tom Friedman were spear points of the whole idea.
Oh, I just wouldn't agree with that they even played an especially major role. If you look at Paul...
No, I don't say what their role was, but they were surely for the war.
Well... I'm sorry. I just don't see that as suggesting that the New York Times was pushing the war. That certainly wasn't my...
I didn't say they were pushing the war. They endorsed it, and Sapphire and Friedman were out front campaigning for it.
As I say, my sense was that the general line of the New York Times was against the war. They played up anti-war protests rather dramatically.
Oh, we'd have a big argument. They never put Robert Byrd on page one, for crying out loud. I mean, they buried, I think, a lot of the dissent, including the demonstration in New York on February 15th. But continue.
Okay, well, now my point's kind of buried. As I was about to say, if you look at Paul Krugman and his efforts to discredit Bush, I mean, they didn't seem to move the polls terribly either. I mean, and that's a much bigger platform than any blog. I mean, I think the fact is, you know, if you want to take something, I mean, I'm very much in support of gay marriage, but if you look at the polls, despite all the fact that there's a lot of pro-gay stuff in the media now, but the polls don't show a whole lot of movement in that direction either, and they show that the public is sort of way behind where you'd think they were if you watched Queer Eye for the Straight Guy or whatever. I mean, it's hard to change people's minds. People, first of all, don't pay much attention for the most part. They tune it out. They're rationally ignorant. And second of all, by the time somebody is an adult in American society, they are pretty used to having people try to sell them things. Hmm. And as a result, they have a lot of resistance to pretty much all forms of persuasive communication. So, you know, it's easy to overstate the impact of any medium of communication in that sense. I think that's not always bad. If you assume that most ideas are dumb, it's probably just as well that most ideas don't catch on.
That nobody's listening. Sum up some basic things about Instapundit, Glenn, if you will. How do you pay for it? What's your circulation? What's your definition of victory? And what's next?
I pay for it by paying the hosting company every month. They bill my credit card, and I do accept donations on the site, and I get enough money to pay my hosting fees. And there's something of a slush fund left over so that I can buy a digital camera or stuff like that and feel like it's not coming out of my pocket too much. And my circulation... it varies. The most I ever got was, I think, 220-something thousand page views, which was at the beginning of the war.
Wow.
Typically, I run about half that on most weekdays, 110,000, 120,000 page views. I don't count unique visitors. I have a counter that purports to, but actually I have two counters that purport to, and they give different numbers, so I don't really believe either of them. I would guess that I have probably about half that many unique visitors, but I have no idea, and estimating that is apparently something of a scam.
You're a big newspaper, though. I mean, you're.
Well, I had a beer with the guy who runs the website for my local newspaper, a Scripps Howard paper that's, you know, pretty big. I mean, it's the monopoly paper in town, and I have somewhat higher figures than them. It's not dramatic, but I'm like 10 or 15% more than them. So it's about the equivalent of a medium-sized, you know, medium cities newspaper's web traffic, which, you know, for what I pay is not a bad deal.
Except they're all over the world, and they're probably smarter than the newspaper readers in the average.
Well, I think my readers are smarter, but, of course, I really can only judge by the people I get email from, and they may be unrepresentative.
So what's the direction for Instapundit? Where's the victory?
Well, the direction for Instapundit is the direction it's always been, which is I will do it as long as it's fun, and I will stop if it starts to feel like work. I mean, it is a hobby for me. It is not a grand effort to reshape the world on my part, and it is not an effort to become rich or famous. It has, I suppose, made me a little bit more famous. It has most definitely not made me rich, and you know, if it stops being fun, I'll go do something else.
I want to know what it is ahead of time.
Oh.
It's fun to talk with a media mogul of the new era. Glenn Reynolds, you do it awfully well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye.